I'm the underbelly, I am the claw. Never one thing, no, not one thing at all. I'm a street fighter, I'm a prayer for peace. I'm a holy roller, I'm a honeybee.
A Poet to a Novelist by William Stafford. When we write, fighting feedback, eat back, da back, back, ach, of the forward part of our brains. A perfect flower blooms from all failure. We hear every wrong number down a tin can telephone line jingle the bells, till the neighbor's ears are supporting the line. Everybody's efforts scaled down, ailed down, da down, down, toward disappearing, all who lunge plunging. We let them go by at the world's pace. There are hills our windows give every winter. When we close the curtain, we know the street light is left outside alone. From the end of the street, this is the edge of the town. The few scant flakes come out of the dark and fall on the house that goes deaf while night fans over the roof. Such arrivals and storms are one kind of chance. A difference we want after our days of doing one thing at a time, the way purpose is. We take everything stacked, being all at once like a jewel, and then into some act we pass calendar knots through our hands, remembering not just important things, maybe the welcome a western town gave early women, dust from the alley past the clothesline, anybody's sky sighting down given streets, years like a fan opening and then closing. We pay it out, still owing what's near us every aid, no matter the worth, because it is near. We hear such blossom syllables in the sounds that rise that we cannot find a path among true words. Redundant honesty of the scrupulous, we go down with what occurs to any length, echoes realer than originals. Coming from cliffs the air belongs on, or comes back to sideways. We happen in the night on orchards that stutter whiteness as the moon passes. Spring comes every night when luck is there. We owe the twilight aid because day once prevailed, the bad parts run a world, ready to face but still present if a person will come out from his eyes and be willing to hold what he views. We welcome all back the child's way, the finding of new things, or sorting through gravel, or discovering the scent of alfalfa that knows water out of the desert in the evening. Over the night arc, our need reaches for duty, our state a glimmer to be good, putting down the last book or finding the light on the wall. By feel and memory, we veered towards the saintly, saying, sorry, but we rebel at only the good. Read and do what you want, and don't even be eager to find the best. No finicky appetites. No place is wide enough to be in, to be sorry in. Not any place. Because you walk for us, we call you this, pilgrim for rain. No one else will meet us low enough to hear the wind and the grass and let it go over our place. We wait low and looking for the oat spire against the sun, leaf and straw, hay attached by accident to the ground. Because we write, we know the cost of every day. The cost is all the rest. Because you know it so, I give you this. Again, that was William Stafford, and the poem was called A Poet to a Novelist. I'm Swan, and you are listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. So today is the 1st of November, and November is National Novel Writing Month. I committed to this last year, and I hated what I wrote, but I wrote every day. And I did not commit to it this year, but perhaps you have. Perhaps you're trying to pull out an idea that's been with you for months or maybe even years. And so to honor that and to honor the creative process in general, I'm going to talk about some creative personalities that can assist you in your artistic journey, whatever it may be, whether it's with words or with something else entirely. The hardest thing, I think, for many creatives is finding motivation that works consistently, because sometimes things don't work consistently. And that's actually a strategy that can be helpful. And maybe finding out why you're wanting to create right now, what's motivating you right now. And maybe if you're curious, look back and see if your motivations have changed. I know that often I'm motivated to create on behalf of other people, that my love and affection for someone will spur an idea of something that I want to write or create, paint, I don't know, for them. And so that's something I've noticed about myself, is that I can sometimes tap into that creative channel when I'm doing it with someone specific in mind. But changing things, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always be where you've always been. A silly cliche my guardian used to say often, but there is truth there. I mean, as humans, I think we really like patterns and structure, but we also get so fed by chaos and the unknown and new things. Another thing I would just encourage is having fun. Ideas have a life cycle. They're born in your mind, they develop and mature, and then they die. And sometimes you get part of a cycle, and sometimes you get to see it from the beginning to the end. But this, I love this idea that ideas are kind of living things. Elizabeth Gilbert, I don't know that she was the first one I encountered with that idea, but she was the first to have a powerful example. She talked about how after Eat, Pray, Love, she had this idea for a book based in Brazil, and she had a general outline, and then her life got very chaotic, and she had to put it away for a year, maybe 2 years. And when she went to revisit it, she didn't feel like the story had any life. During this time, she had met the author Ann Patchett, and they had exchanged a kiss, a spontaneous kiss, and then began writing letters. And Liz mentioned that she lost energy for this idea, and Ann mentioned that she had just gotten an idea that she'd been working on for a while. And through talking about it, they discovered that it wasn't the same story. It was, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert's version of the story versus Anne Patchett's version of the story, but that it was a lot of similarities, more than would be happenstance. And I love the magic of an idea being exchanged through a kiss or through a touch or through proximity, because maybe you're not in a space to manifest it, and ideas are alive. They want to, you know, grow and be living. And yeah, random tangent. Anyways, so the thing that I would love to talk about is disseminated from ideas from someone that I discovered this past year, I would say, maybe a year and a half ago. Roger von Oeck. He wrote a couple things, a whack on the side of the head and a kick in the seat of the pants. And this information is getting pulled from his book, A Kick in the Seat of the Pants. And the subtitle is Using Your Explorer, Artist, Judge, and Warrior to Be More Creative. So what the hell does that mean? I will tell you. This is based on him and his working with a variety of creative people, and not only people who are obvious, but people who are, I don't know, less obvious. He mentions software developers, managers, TV producers, comedians, market strategists, journalists, scientists, designers, and through that he talks about how the thing that he finds that most successful creatives have is flexible thinking, flexible mentalities, and are people who are able to shift and transition and adapt. And these are skills that can be developed, so that's exciting. You're not just born with them or not. But he breaks down these ideas into four roles, an explorer, an artist, a judge, and a warrior. And he, so first the explorer, if you think about maybe a past project or where you are currently with a project, you need some raw materials, you need some ideas, some like concepts, some things that have meaning and context that you're trying to explore. And you can look for these in a number of places, or sometimes you are exposed to something new and unexpected that kind of sparks an idea. And so for him, the explorer is that part of your personality that is looking for materials to build. You're searching, you're experimenting, you're paying attention, looking for patterns and seeking out a variety of different information from different sources. And then he goes into the artist is the person, the role of the artist is to grab different parts of that information, that you have a lot of information coming into you, and the artist is the one that kind of pulls out the things that are speaking the strongest, and then the artist taps into intuition, rearranges things, looks at them different ways, backwards, upside down, asks questions, basically just develops the parts of the idea that have the most vibrancy, the most life and energy. And artists can break rules, create their own rules. This is the experimental, exciting part of being a creative. I feel like the artist role is the thing that people talk about, getting into the zone and just kind of doing something and feeling that flow. Eventually, I feel like most people get around to asking, wait, is this good or bad? Enter the judge, often also deemed the inner critic. This is that voice in your head that says, is this worthy of pursuit? Is this valuable? Do I want something back from it? Do I have what I need to make it happen? Kind of the more analytical piece, evaluating and weighing the project, looking for obstacles and drawbacks and gaps, things that don't fit right. So this is the part that, you know, you can write something, and then the commonly held advice is write something and then set it aside so that you have the opportunity to create some space between what you just wrote and what is actually there. And then when you revisit it, the judge is the thing that says, oh, this is an inconsistency. This character needs a little bit more backstory. It feels a little cliche or hollow. It's the one that's an analyzing, questioning assumptions, and making decisions. And then the mighty warrior is your advocate, your the belief, I guess, that you have that, yes, this is something that is a thing that I want to push into the world. It's the part of you that goes to battle, that defends, that goes, you know, submits after rejection and more rejection. As a writer, that's success. Getting rejection slips is part of the process, and I really admire. I've only submitted a handful of things, and I've been rejected for everything. But that's, I mean, I feel like we talked last week about late bloomers versus the early bloomer prodigy type archetype with creatives. And I feel like the tenacity has to be there for the majority of creatives who are successful, that some part of you is doing something even though it's not being picked up yet. So your warrior is the one that's competitive, that keeps you going despite competition, that's, you know, creating an offensive strategy, committing yourself to a course, to completion, and having the discipline to go through the bad parts and the good parts, overcoming excuses, idea killers, setbacks, obstacles, negative people in your community, and gives you the courage to do what will make your idea a real thing rather than just an idea. Yeah, so those are the quick rundown: explorer, artist, judge, and warrior. And I would like to talk more today about that exploration role, because that's, I think, well, you know, National Novel Writing Month is a catalyst for many people to do something that the rest of the year they can't do. And the energy that comes of doing something with a lot of people and, you know, hitting obstacles and commiserating and celebrating successes with others is a huge part of, it's just so different than that creative isolation that often comes for writers. But writing is very lonely. You have to sit down and you have to write, and that's something that most people can only do alone. Some people can do it with other people, I guess, in coffee shops and bars and cafes. I know that I like to be alone. I know that that's not abnormal. So, going first into the words of the great Leonardo da Vinci, he says, "I roamed the countryside searching for answers to things I did not understand. Why shells existed on the tops of mountains, along with the imprints of coral and plants and seaweed usually found in the sea. Why the thunder lasts a longer time than that which causes it, and why immediately on its creation the lightning, which becomes visible to the eye, while thunder requires time to travel. How the various circles of water form around the spot which has been struck by a stone, and why a bird sustains itself in the air. These questions and other strange phenomena engaged my thought throughout my life." As a creative, you have to foster and cultivate your ability for curiosity. Often research is heavily involved in making things, and in order to pursue that, there's got to be curiosity fueling it. And you also need raw materials of creativity: facts, theories, concepts, rules, information, feelings, impressions. And to help you bring them out of you, your explorer personality, your explorer character. And then also, I love finding stories through meeting a character in the real world, or a character that's part of yourself, something in your mind. I think writing is psychological in the sense that you're really just pulling out different facets of your own personality, and not saying that you're villainous or anything, but those are parts that are somewhere inside of you giving voice to the ideas of the characters. Anyways, I love the visual of an explorer in reference to this, someone who's just expanding known horizons, like, you know, the terrible conquistadors of olden days, but just that person who's pushing to know more about the world than is currently known. So put on your explorer costume, and let's continue. So exploring is like looking for gold. If you look for gold in everywhere that you've always looked, you tap out on the resource. You become depleted. If you're curious and you look in new areas, you improve your chances of finding new ideas. You need to venture off the beaten path path. This is that change thing, that forcing yourself to do something new or go somewhere new or have a conversation with someone new. And Roger calls this the insight outlook. It's the attitude where there's good information available all around you all of the time, and all you need to do is develop your sight to see it. Everything has the potential to come together and form something new. And, you know, you can pull ideas from an airport, from a museum. You can find ideas at hardware stores, garbage dumps, boutiques, libraries, parking garages, wilderness areas, restaurants, botanical gardens, and classrooms. And honestly, the more variety you have in the sources feeding you, there's a better chance that what you're creating is going to be varied and colorful as well. So there's some strategies for searching, right? You don't just start walking. Some people do, perhaps, but you usually want to kind of prepare, find a strategy, utilize knowledge sets, being able to create maps. Something I love about one person I follow on Patreon, Ksenia Anka, I think is her last name. It's not right in front of me, so I hope I didn't mispronounce. But she, as part of her service to Patreons, sends out, you know, outlines and sends out her development process from, you know, the beginning of an idea through the steps and the information that she's gathered and the skills that she's utilizing. But as any good explorer would tell you, having a strategy is helpful. Having, you know, being able to do research, being able to track data as it's coming in. So there's always a lot going on that is something that's coming out of just this life. I'm getting breathless. Okay. So there's always a lot going on, you know, even if you're in a quiet room, maybe there's a fan running or things happening outside, things happening in your mind. There's never nothing going on. This life is kind of like a noisy cocktail party. There's people talking, glasses, music. You can connect with people in that environment because you're paying attention, right? So it's developing the skill to tune in certain things and tune out other things. And so what I would like for you to do right now is just pause where you are and look at everything around you that's blue. Go on, I'll give you some time. So I like blue, so there's a lot of it. I have a book in front of me that's blue. I have a blue pen. My coffee pot is blue. I have a blue rug. There's a blue backpack, a blue speaker, blue candles. I have a blue shirt. And that's what I can see from where I'm sitting. How about you? This is a blue mindset. Because you're looking for it, you can pull out, your brain allows you to pull out everything around you that's blue very quickly, and because you're looking for it, because I just asked you to. So similarly, when you're learning a new word, then you suddenly notice that word everywhere. It's attention. It's the things that you're paying attention to you suddenly see more. I don't know if you've ever made a large purchase and then suddenly you notice that the example Roger gives is a car. If you buy a car, suddenly you notice that car everywhere, whereas before you didn't. You find what you're looking for. If you're looking for a conspiracy, you'll probably find a conspiracy. If you're looking for, I don't know, whatever whatever you're looking for, you tend to discover. It's the issue with objective science is you want to prove what you're looking for, but what you're really trying to do is to disprove, to challenge the thinking and the assumptions that you're making. So part of this is asking the right questions. So asking yourself, what is it that you're paying attention to? What is it that you're trying to find? Intention with your attention. Attention, intention. Intention, attention. Say that fast and try. Okay. Anyways, so you're, I mean, the standard stereotype is that artists are able to see the world differently or, you know, put things into a different perspective and then offer that back to the public. But that's something that anyone can do. It's creating the intention to do that. Often experts will come across something that creates something completely different. Everything crosses over. So I think about the TED conference, how they're bringing together technology, entertainment, and design to create interesting collaborations with people who might not ordinarily communicate one with another. And people love that because it feeds ideas, right? It helps you see the information that you have in a different light. It helps you create different neural connections. So some examples of what I'm talking about. There was a football coach, Newt Rockne. I don't know if I said that right. He got the idea for his four horsemen backfield shift while watching a burlesque chorus routine. Dan Bricklin took the spreadsheet concept from accounting and turned it into a VisiCalc, the program that created the microcomputer software industry. World War II military designers borrowed from the cubist art of Picasso and Braque to create more effective camouflage patterns for tanks and guns. Mathematician John von Neumann analyzed poker table behavior and developed the game theory model of economics. The unbreakable U.S. military code used in World War II was based on the Navajo language. The Wright brothers were bicycle repairmen. There's advertising people who pull ideas from biology, software programmers who get inspiration from songwriters, investors who spot new opportunities by going to junkyards. It's not surprising that Thomas Edison gave his colleagues the advice, make it a practice to keep on the lookout for novel and interesting ideas that others have used successfully. Your idea has to be original only in its adaptation to the problem you are working on. So creating something new based on fitting together things that you are, I don't know, something that you know, seen in a new light or in a new context. Actual field that I think of that implements this is the bioengineering, which pulls things from nature in order to solve human problems. There's an interesting video someone sent me about this, but, you know, even just the standard, like, what is it called? The Velcro came from weeds, right? From burdock burrs and their hooked spines. It's just like creating things from things. Someone said there's no new ideas, and that's possibly true, but there also are lots of new ideas because you're the only person who's pulling in from all of your experiences and combining things in new and interesting ways. Yay! If you just tuned in, this is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Make sure you subscribe to wherever you listen to podcasts and let me know what you think. Ink and Worm, all lowercase, all spelled out, at or at gmail.com. And then also check out Radio Free Brooklyn, a wonderful community in Brooklyn, hosting a variety of events and hosting a variety of radio shows about a variety of subjects. Basically, it's just variety, vagabond, eclectic variety, all around, good music, good times.
Let's see.
So what's the best way to get a good idea? Well, Linus Pauling said, the best way to get a good idea is to get a lot of ideas. So your explorer is your brainstormer, your creative thinker, your problem solver, looking at things that seem unusual, seem low probability, seem like what are the odds that that thing would be happening? And just generate so many ideas, because that increases your chances of finding something that sparks, something that has light and heat coming off of it. And even if you don't use ideas in the moment, they're still out there. They're still, you know, they're still alive. They're still growing and changing, and they might come back to you in a different form someday, or they might, you know, like a electron just bounce to someone who's in proximity with you in whatever way and go on that way. But your explorer is the part of you that has the attitude that everything is valuable, nothing is worthless, and you're just gathering. You're taking lots of pictures, you're writing down lots of things, you're experimenting, you're changing things, especially, you know, in this day of technology where the cost of really gathering and exploring a lot of ideas isn't as high. It doesn't, the personal investment is not quite as steep. And then you can, you know, and then you can tap into the things that, I don't know, are speaking to you in that time, in that moment. Lots of ideas. There's a computer scientist, Alan Kay. He's the man who coined the term personal computer. And he said, if you take the smartest people you know and give them a glass of wine so that they'll really level with you, they'll tell you that 19 out of 20 ideas they have aren't any good. But it's because they generate so many ideas that they're able to come up with a few exceptional ones. Your explorer is just throwing shit at the wall. And the more shit you throw at the wall, eventually the more shit is going to stick to the wall. But that's not literal. I would not recommend actually throwing shit at the wall. Maybe you could throw darts at the wall. You can write your ideas on darts. Throw them on a wall. Okay, I'm being a nerd. There's an inventor who also, Ray Dolby, you might recognize the name Dolby. He revolutionized recorded music. He said, inventing a skill that some people have and some people don't. Inventing is a skill that some people have and some people don't. But you can learn how to invent. You have the will not to jump at the first solution, because the really elegant solution might be just around the corner. The most likely inventor candidate would be someone who says, yes, that's one way to do it, but it doesn't seem to be the optimum solution. Then he keeps on thinking. So that's the explorer. You might get an idea, you just keep getting ideas as an explorer. You're looking for, it's the abstract thinking, it's the challenging, the easy path, the natural course, the next logical thing, and putting things into a different context so that you start thinking differently and your mental and neural capacities begin to change. If you are answering questions with one answer, you are limiting yourself. So Roger says, you know, find multiple answers. He talks about the second answer. It's a strategy of the explorer. Yes, you find something, you find an idea, you find a question. What's the first answer? Okay, what's the second answer? What's a different possibility? Creative thinking is not limited to the real world. You can go anywhere and do anything. And the more ideas you generate for, you know, contexts, the more adaptable your mind becomes and the more easily it pairs things that don't logically go together. Some questions. Looking at images that are abstract or like they're brain teaser images, like what do you see? Can spur that because your brain sees something, but then if you push it, it will start seeing other things. Another question, spur your creativity. How do you keep a fish from smelling? You catch a fish. How do you keep it from stinking? Options. Cook it as you catch it. Freeze it. Wrap it in paper. Keep a cat around. Burn incense. Leave it in water. Or cut off its nose. So, explore tip, pro tip, look past the first answer. Look past the first thing that comes to you. And that's where you'll start to explore the territory of the unexpected and unknown. More historical examples. Alexander Graham Bell was trying to invent a hearing aid when he invented the phone. Columbus was looking for India. Colonel Sanders set out to sell his chicken recipe to restaurants. Physicist Carl Jansky improvised a new antenna to study the effects of telephone static. Instead, he discovered radio waves from the Milky Way and in the process helped create the science of radio astronomy. Often what we're looking for leads us to something different. It's important for the explorer to be willing to get lost, to be led astray. When you're exploring, you're trying to quiet that judge, that practical mind, and just explore. Steve Jobs has said, in response to the question, why are some people more creative than others? He said, innovation is usually the result of connections of past experiences and luck. But if you have the same experiences as everybody else, you're unlikely to look in a different direction. For example, I went to Reed College in Portland. At Reed, most of the men took modern dance classes from a woman named Judy Macy. We did it to meet the women. I didn't realize how much I had learned about movement and perception from that class until a few years later when I worked for Nolan Bushnell at Atari. I was able to relate how much resolution of movement you need in terms of perceiving things in certain ways for video games. He was trying to get a date by taking a dance class and instead ended up fine-tuning the video game Breakout. So think about things in your life where one thing led to another, which led to another. How did you find your career path? How did you find your line of work? How did you meet your spouse? These are stories I love. I love asking questions about how people met each other because I love the answers because you, I don't know, how do you meet people? Think about how many times you've gone to a library looking for one book and end up with something completely different. It happens to me all the time. I'm terrible, by the way. I love that I'm terrible, but I'll go to the library with the intention of only returning things. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to bring back these things. I already have a stack of books that I'm working on. And every time I leave with at least four other books, at least four. And I'm just walking away from the library in awe of myself because I am ridiculous. But information is so often acquired by looking up something and then finding something else along the way. That's something I love about the random idea generator, or Wikipedia has a random page generator, because you can be reading about something and your brain associations will pull it somewhere else and spark something different. So Expect the unexpected. Keep your eyes open. Keep your mind open. You know, that blue mind that we explored earlier. When you're looking for blue, you find it everywhere. Do something completely different from what you usually do. I know that this is also something that is a variable in happiness. I remember reading The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin, and she talks about getting different magazines and different things to read that she never would have read. Things about like equestrian things, and she's like, I've never been around horses. But for her, entering that information, she's associating it with the things she knows, possibly creating new associations. So that's a good place to start. Pick up an unusual magazine, maybe something from a political point of view that's the opposite of yours. That's just a random suggestion, not related to anything that's happening in the world. Try volunteering at a school or at a senior center, somewhere that you are interacting with a population of people that you would not ordinarily interact with. Try going to work 2 hours early. See what happens. Try and, I don't know, attend a council meeting. Test drive a car that you would never actually buy. Try a new recipe. Go to a different city. Study ancient history. Anything that's something that's not something in your usual repertoire is an opportunity to be your explorer self. Pay attention. Look for patterns that you wouldn't have noticed. Try and set aside logic and, or, you know, check into all your senses, really. Check in with how something feels, how something smells. You know, the senses that are not your natural aptitudes are great opportunities for exploration, right? So I often tell people that I'm very kinesthetic. For me, I really like doing something, and I have a hard time visualizing spaces in my mind. But it's something that I enjoy doing because I'm not good at it, because it's uncomfortable for me. And it therefore becomes an opportunity for me to push against something mentally that I don't often get to encounter. The other challenge of the explorer is to gather new resources, but also to use the resources that are right in front of you. Use materials in your house right now to create some kind of a model rather than going out to a store and buying something. Creative thinking is often inspired necessity is the mother of invention, that whole thing. The idea that if you are trying to do something, for example, paint, and you're like, oh, but I don't have any paint and I don't have any paper, well, maybe you use your coffee and your finger on a napkin. I don't know. That's a weird example. But challenging yourself to do something where the materials are not readily available to you inspires creative thinking. It sparks that explorer mind that is curious and open to suggestions and looking for more answers. That was my coffee. Attention. I can't say it enough. Attention. Small things have a big impact, especially when they're combined with other things. For example, a small change in the weather has large ramifications. You know, they lead to droughts and floods and storms, and as we're noticing, nature loves balancing itself out, but also cause and effect. Oh, this is interesting. So swimming, why are swimmers so much faster today than they are to swimmers 20 years ago? Ask yourself that question. Is it just better coaching, different size, better dietary, better understanding of technique? But there is something that actually had a huge impact, and that's the lightweight binocular swimming goggle. Because chlorine irritates the eyes, and the invention of lightweight goggles protected the eyes of swimmers so that they could swim longer. So that's why I don't know. Okay. Part of that explore mind is the phenomenon of not seeing the trees, and because you're looking at the forest or not seeing the forest, the trees, that thing. So the explorer stands back, relaxes, looks at larger picture, larger implications. I'm trying to decide what else I want to say because I think I'm running out of time. Explorers are the ones slaying dragons. What, you may ask? Well, dragons are. Well, this is based. Okay, so this is definitely Roger's idea. Where are the places you're afraid to look for ideas? Question for you. Centuries ago, when map makers ran out of known world before they ran out of parchment, they would sketch a dragon at the edge of the scroll. This was a sign to the explorer that he would be entering unknown territory at his own risk. Often, explorers took this literally and were afraid to push on, because who wants to encounter a living dragon? But some saw it as an opportunity and a challenge, a door to unexplored territory. Yay, that's where you want to go. The part that's unknown for you is opportunity. Your brain creates naturally mental maps that contains the information you use to guide yourself every day. And like the explorers of old, your mental maps have dragons. They're the things that, for whatever reason, you don't want to go to or you don't want to push past. The things that make you uncomfortable. For you, maybe a dancing class would make you incredibly uncomfortable, but years later, you might be able to pull that skill set out in an unexpected way. But I'm not guaranteeing that you will be Steve Jobs by any means, because I don't know. You might be, though. You might be the next Steve Jobs. It's possible. What prevents you from exploring new information? So, what are your personal dragons? Are they danger or are they opportunity? And if they're opportunity, shouldn't you be taking a better look? Another strategy of explorers are using obstacles to break out of ruts. You have your routine. Now, challenge yourself to try and shorten it. Try and cut it in half. Do you eliminate things? Do you do things quicker? I don't know. This is just an idea. Let me see. Yeah, it's reprogramming. Your explorer intentionally puts interruptions into your routine. It changes your hours. Makes you take a different way to work. It li makes you listen to different radio stations and cultivate new and different friends. Try a different recipe. Anything that's different is good. It's that explorer mind coming to use, and ideas can come from that. And also ideas that you also already have. using the things around you, the skill set, you know, the things that you know a lot about are great for going deeper. So first, you already know them. Never mind. I don't know what I'm talking about now. I'm getting tired and I'm create associations with the things that you know by looking at them in a different way. And sometimes you get so familiar with something that you stop seeing it, right? Maybe. No. No one. Conceptual things, I think. Asking yourself questions. There's a lovely collection of things, different visuals and explorations. But the last thing I want to mention is writing it down. As humans, we have terrible memories sometimes, often. But things can come to you at any time, and if you don't catch them in the moment, those ideas will go off to someone else. And then also that idea that the more ideas you collect, the more chance of finding that idea that will be the thing for you to pursue at that time. Write things down, write things down, write things down, even if it's mundane and silly. Also acknowledging where your ideas come. If they come in the shower, then by all means, find a way to write that stuff down in the shower. A lot of people I know keep a journal by their bed because when you relax, either coming in or out of sleep, you're able to grab things differently. And so that's a good time to gather ideas. So, in conclusion, your explorer is your searcher, the looking and probing part of yourself. When you adopt this role, you're venturing off the beaten path, you're looking around, you're paying attention to different kinds of information than you ordinarily would. When you do this role well, you have more to gather to feed your artist. This can be scary. It's easy to get stuck in routines. It's easy to say, I don't have the energy to break out of my routine. But do you want something new or do you want what you've always had? And also, you could get lost or hurt. I mean, that's scary. That's a survival mechanism, right? But if you cultivate that explore mind, you learn to accommodate for risk and you learn to trust your intuition. And the last thing is, that last obstacle is just not, our culture is... encourages specialization, knowing a lot about a little. People who are only good with hammers see every problem as a nail, right? So to be an effective explorer, maintain your flexibility, courage, and openness. So quick recap, be curious. Explorers are curious. This is that insight outlook, you know, look for one thing and you'll find it. If you're looking for it, you see it. Create a map for yourself. Have an idea of what you're looking for. Leave your own turf. Look outside fields, disciplines, industries. Too much is not enough. Gather as many ideas as you can. Don't be afraid to be led astray. You'll find what you weren't looking for. Break up your routine. Use obstacles to get out of ruts. Shift your focus. Pay attention to a variety of information. And don't overlook the obvious. What is right in front of you? Get out your magnifying glass. Big things come in small packages. What does it all really mean? Step back. Look at the big picture. In art, this is that, like, fog in your eyes. So you can kind of see. It's really helpful if you have glasses. But it's where you really step back and look at the image that you're creating so that you can see it. Because often when you're painting, you're too close to it. And slay a dragon. Look for ideas in a place you've been avoiding. Remember where you've been. Trigger the ideas that you already have. Stake your claim to new territory. Write your idea down when you find it. So I invite you, as you're beginning the month of November, to cultivate your explorer role, whether you're doing that in the context of writing a novel this month, or whether you're doing that in the context of trying to break up the monotony of your life. I would love to leave you with a writing moment. This is brought to you from the book If You Want to Write by Brenda Uhland. And this is chapter 7. Be careless, reckless, be a lion, be a pirate when you write. Now I want to tell you some things I have learned about writing from my class. Though everybody is talented and original, often it does not break through for a long time. People are too scared, too self-conscious, too proud, too shy. They have been taught too many things about construction, plot, unity, mass, and coherence. My little brother wrote a composition when he was 12, and almost every third sentence was, but alas, to no avail. That is the sort of thing that everybody does for many years. That is because they have been taught that writing is something special and not just talking on paper. Another trouble with writers is in the first 20 years is an anxiety to be effective, to impress people. They write pretentiously. It is hard not to do this. That was my trouble. For many years, it puzzled me why so many things I wrote were pretentious, lying, high-sounding, and in consequence, utterly dull and uninteresting. It was a regular horror to read them again. Of course, they did not sell either, not one of them. The explanation of this is I learned from my class. Again and again, after the first few weeks, a kind of rollicking encouragement, they would all, even those with work, whose work seemed hopelessly dull, trite, angular, and commonplace, they would break through this, as from a cocoon, and write suddenly in a living, true, touching, remarkable way. It would happen suddenly, overnight. They would break through from the composition writing, theme writing, to some freedom and honesty, and to writing with what I call microscopic truthfulness. What made them do this, I think I know. I think I helped them to do it. And I did not do it by criticism, by pointing out all the mediocrities in their efforts, and so making them contract and try nervously to avoid all sorts of faults. I helped them by trying to make them feel freer and bolder. Let her go, be careless, reckless, be a lion, be a pirate, write any old way. Francesca helped me understand this. When giving violin lessons, she never tells a child that she is playing a bad note. Why do that? He knows it himself. All are trying to get nearer and nearer to true pitch, to perfection anyway. Why fix their attention on avoidance of mistakes? It just tightens them up, contracts them, and makes them dislike lessons. Moreover, when they are thinking so vividly about the bad notes that they are warned to avoid, they play them again and again, just as a man learning to ride a bicycle goes into the tree he is afraid of. To play a note truly, as the simplest person knows, your mind must be on the true note, your imagination hearing it as you want to play it. I found that many gifted people are so afraid of writing a poor story that they cannot summon the nerve to write a single sentence for months. The thing to say to such people is, see how bad a story you can write. See how dull you can be. Go ahead, that would be fun and interesting. I'll give you $10 if you can write something thoroughly dull from beginning to end. And of course no one can. Try this yourself. It is a relief, and you see then how you are not dull at all. It is just as guilty people who are always trying to be so good should try to be very bad and resolve to stick to it. They would find then how natural it comes to them to be good and would not strain after it, which makes them hypocrites, though in a nice way. Well, when I told the timid people in the class to see how badly they could write, it would give them the courage to venture a few little sentences, and since everybody who is human cannot say a sentence without revealing something mild or violent, waggish in their souls, or without having something fine in it, I would point this out. Courage would expand, and they would gradually write more. To show you how people's writing expands under encouragement, I will tell you of some of my pupils, and what happened to these few happened to all of them, except, as I say, to those to whom writing is an easy, glib, superficial babbling. For these are apt to give it up soon before they break through the shell of glibness to what is true underneath. Sarah is an Irish and unmarried and perhaps 30. Is an Irish. She is Irish. These are not real names, by the way. She is plainly and humbly dressed, and because of her pallor and wide cheekbones and slanting eyes, she looks Chinese in a very beautiful way. She is so shy that she cannot look at you directly, but when she talks, she cannot keep her sad face immobile, but has to smile widely and reluctantly every now and then, from both humor and bashfulness. She is a stenographer and works 9 hours a day in the sub-basement of a department store. The first writing she showed me was a fat little notebook, about an inch and a half thick. It was filled with neat typing. 4 Days in Glacier Park by Sarah McShane, 1935. The first sentence was, there's always something fascinating about a passing freight train, the big black engine car, big black engine with ugly bony arm on its side, and the string of boxcars with sometimes a munificent supply of tramps sitting on the top, the heavy oil tanks, and the bringing up the rear, the stove-piped caboose. One and all, from youth to old age, will stand and watch it in silence and interest. Well, as soon as I read the big black engine with the ugly bony arm on its side, I knew she could write. She could see things and describe things, and she saw what she saw and felt she put down. She did not have the impulse, as those of us who are better educated, to put down what she felt and then think, no, it must be fancier than this, like the engine, like a charging steed of prairies, or plainer, the engine with its high wheels. What she felt, what struck her, was the ugly bony arm on its side, so she put that down. And that was a good beginning. I told her what a graphic description these few words were. As I read along, I came to this. The new air-conditioned train was a curiosity in itself. No cinders, no smoke, no stifling air. Instead, an even, cool, clean atmosphere. The interior was painted a delicate green, a bath or bedroom shade. There were new silver racks for suitcases, small, delicate, white lights for nighttime, and soft, easy parlor chair seats for the passengers. A deluxe layout, it was indeed. From this, I could see and tell her that she had a simple open eye and noticing everything with a quiet pleasure and put it down just as she saw it. And she had a quiet enthusiasm. She liked pretty colors, delicate green, silver. And this naive truthfulness and enthusiasm, a love for things, showed that there was a great deal of poetry and creative power in Sarah, and that she was a simple and good person, which also would show in her writing and shine through it. And she chose simple, short, poetic words the way the poets in Ireland do. She was Irish and had a soft and beautiful voice. That, I saw at once, meant that she could write too. In the fat notebook, she told everything that she noticed, what time trains pulled in and out, and the towns they passed. Familiar things slid by us as we chugged along from one twin city to the other, smokestacks and stinks, tanks, houses and trees, gaudy signboards, and big flour mills. The Mississippi River all rolled by in panoramic review. Out at Wayzata, Lake Minnesota, a cold blue color lay stretched to the left, shivering in rolling white caps. Mirrored in its waters was the sun's golden face, haloed in an effect of glittering color. I like this description very much, shivering in rolling white caps. That was just right because she told it as she felt it, and so I felt it too. The sun's golden face haloed in an effect of glittering color. I liked that too. I like it now as I write it. She told of the hotels they stayed in. How can I stay here, I thought, the minute I stepped inside the door. The rough woodwork gave the room a cold, woodsy, rainy day touch. Martha was more easily pleased. She plunked herself down in the wicker chair and pulled off her shoes. From this fine sentence I saw and knew then all about Martha. For dinner, that first evening we had fruit compote, chicken okra soup with a heaping dish of crackers, grilled sirloin, and a little bell-shaped cup with a ball of something in it, mashed potatoes, buttered peas, creamed onions, celery, buns and coffee, and for dessert, butterscotch ice cream and cake. Yes, she could write because she told everything simply as it was and didn't put on airs. After studying the glacier, we spent some time watching the mountain goats on the rocky crags of the peaks. With the human eye, we could only faintly make them out, white specks moving around. One lady, the wife of a big man, had a pair of field glasses, and she let us look through them. After I looked through them for a long time, she asked, "Did you see the goats?" "Yes." I was merely being polite. "But I didn't see the goats. I didn't see anything. All I saw was the blurred, watery surface of the lens. I have never been able to see any more than that through field glasses." The class burst out laughing when I read this. "You see, you are funny, too," I said to Sarah. "See how they are laughing? You write wonderfully well, and you have good humor, too." She reddened with delight. That was from If You Want to Write, a book about art, independence, and spirit by Brenda Uhland. Thanks for listening. This has been Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. My name is Swan, and I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Bumfuzzle.